From PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Powell. There was more division in the closing stages of the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in Sri Lanka, this time over climate change. Australia has joined Canada in refusing to sign onto a fund to finance climate change initiatives. The move follows days of controversy over Sri Lanka's approach to its human rights record. For more from Sri Lanka, here is Tom Igudin.
A communique calling for cooperation on, amongst other things, climate change brought more disharmony to a meeting that's already had its fair share. Australia and Canada refused to commit money to a green capital fund, agreed on by the rest of the meeting to help finance projects to combat global warming. The New Zealand Prime Minister said Australia wanted to see more evidence the fund would make a difference. The strength of the alliance of Commonwealth leaders has been under pressure for days at this year's CHOGM after British Prime Minister David Cameron eschewed the briefing rooms of Colombo for a tour of the troubled Jaffna area. He then demanded an independent investigation into allegations of torture and rape before abruptly departing the country. Sri Lankan President Mahinda Rajapaksa was still on the defensive as CHOGM wrapped up last night.
We respect values of the Commonwealth. We are members of the Commonwealth.
With most Commonwealth leaders refusing to confront the host country's apparent violation of the Commonwealth's basic principles, the closing press conference descended into farce.
Please, be fair. This is the only thing that I ask from you all, especially from foreign media. Help us. You all can help us not to get the people divided.
Tony Abbott put domestic politics at the forefront of his CHOGM experience. He refused to criticise Sri Lanka, who he describes as an ally in the battle against people smuggling.
There would not be a Commonwealth leader who does not want the best for Sri Lanka.
The Prime Minister's describing a gift of two patrol boats to the Sri Lankan Navy as a humanitarian offering.
This is about saving life at sea. There are few more important humanitarian issues in our neighbourhood right now than stopping the flow of boats, which in Australia's case has been associated with more than 1,000 deaths at sea.
But it's a very different humanitarian approach to David Cameron's mercy mission to Jaffna.
So you agree with David Cameron that there needs to be an independent investigation into these war crimes allegations, or do you agree with President Rajapaksa that no such investigation needs to be undertaken?
There are investigations ongoing at the moment in Sri Lanka. There is a judicial inquiry into disappearances, and there is ongoing work under the Lessons Learned and Reconciliation Commission.
A major regional meeting in the Thai capital is under threat of being overshadowed by political protests over the past few days over the proposed amnesty legislation. About 4,000 delegates from the region have gathered in Bangkok for the 11th International Congress on AIDS in Asia and the Pacific, or ICAAP. Iskandar Razik speaks to Radio Australia's Sen Lam for more.
Well, the organisers tell me the protests were at the other end of town, closer to the older administrative area, so perhaps not quite so disruptive. Now, I was at the ICAP registration last night, and the quite cavernous hall was crowded. It was filled with people, and these were local grassroots, Thai grassroots organisations, definitely many NGOs among them, and I think it's safe to assume that Thais are interested in issues other than politics. Now, participants at this ICAP Congress, the 11th one so far, they come from China, from India, PNG, Australia, Fiji, Vietnam. They're all here, about 4,000 people, as you say, in Bangkok. Now, there are also many, many side meetings apart from the big ones, and it's these local community and NGO groups from Asia and the Pacific that ICAP is all about. The theme this year is triple zero, that is zero new infections, zero AIDS-related deaths, and also, quite importantly, zero tolerance for discrimination. Now, UNAIDS, of course, is expected to release a key report in a few hours' time. Unfortunately, I don't have the details, but I can tell you that it's likely to issue a mixed report card for Asia and the Pacific. Now, we know from earlier figures released this year that some Asian countries have managed to halve infection rates, but there's also a high prevalence of HIV infections in some key population groups, such as sex workers, or men who have sex with men, not necessarily gay men, but men who have sex with men, and this is called MSM. So certainly there's no room for complacency, even if gains had been made.
And Sen, if you had to distill it, what do you think are some of the current preoccupations of NGOs and other stakeholders when it comes to dealing with HIV and AIDS in the Asia-Pacific region?
If you look at the conference program, you think how many trees died for this. It's a thick document. But that in itself shows the complicated and varied nature of HIV/AIDS, so many dimensions to this one disease. There's the issue of inequity, of course, of access to treatment. Thousands of people die needlessly because their countries can't afford the expensive cocktail of drugs that make up the anti-HIV arsenal. Another worrying trend is a rise in MSM infections, that's men having sex with men. There's also speculation, you know, are these infections rising because young men are becoming more reckless, or is it because community attitudes and indeed legal discrimination in some countries against homosexuality? Does that mean that men are too frightened to be even tested? There are also, travel restrictions against people with HIV/AIDS are still in some countries, and I think at last count it was about 11 countries in the Asia-Pacific region, so that's a cause for concern as well. Not to mention compulsory detention, if not jail, for people who use drugs. So all in all, it's fair to say, I think, that HIV/AIDS is still an illness, a disease that's surrounded by very, very strong punitive environment.
And just finally, you're in Bangkok as a guest of UNAIDS, and you're the only Australian journalist to be invited to be part of the Asia-Pacific Media AIDS Network. Just briefly, what's the role of the media here?
Well, that's what we are going to find out when we meet for the first time tomorrow. High on the agenda, though, is to explore ways of ensuring HIV/AIDS, this disease that is still killing, that it does not fall off the media radar. Now, has the banner fallen off as a story? That's also what we need to determine. What might HIV reporting look like as we approach the Millennium Development Goals? Now, you will remember that those goals were set about 5 years ago for 2015. That seemed like a long time, but now it's only a year away. And, of course, next year is when Melbourne hosts the World AIDS Congress as well in July. So, sure, scientific gains and breakthroughs are important. What about the human dimension? What's happening there in the lead-up to the MDGs? Are we achieving it? HIV/AIDS, of course, is more than about just medicine and science. It's an unfolding story on two fronts, actually. There's the science of finding a vaccine and a cure, and then there's the struggle, the human struggle against HIV/AIDS.
Indonesia says it's not satisfied with a statement to the Australian Parliament by Prime Minister Tony Abbott regarding the recent revelations about his country's spying activities. The ABC, that's the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, revealed this week that Australia attempted to tap the phones of President Suyo Bambang Yudhoyono, his wife, and 8 government ministers. Indonesia has recalled its ambassador and demanded an explanation. George Roberts reports from Jakarta.
A small survey of Jakarta residents walking to work shows some anger towards reports of Australia spying.
First they interfered in the East Timor crisis, and now they do another one. This is reopening an old wound from the East Timor separation.
Firstly, I'm in shock and feel humiliated. I feel like vulnerable, unsafe. They're smarter, they have technological advantages, and it makes them able to do it.
A little bit angry, disappointed, of course, why it can happen to our government, to our country.
Those might not be everyone's views, but it's what matters to the president. There's mounting political pressure for him not to appear weak and to take a hard line against Australia. The country's Foreign Affairs Minister Marty Natalegawa has been following orders.
We're also reviewing the relationship between Indonesia and Australia in general, not only in regards to the relationship between Indonesia and Australia when it comes to information and intelligence exchange, to ensure that it's not just business as usual.
The Australian Prime Minister's refusal to clarify what surveillance has been or is done hasn't helped. Tony Abbott told Parliament yesterday that Australia shouldn't have to apologise for or give details of its intelligence operations. President Susilo Bungbung Yudhoyono is still waiting for a sufficient explanation. His spokesman and advisor Tuku Faizer Shah says the President doesn't accept Tony Abbott's statement.
What we expect is to have a formal response from the government, not through the domestic settings within the Australian politics.
So should Mr. Abbott come to Jakarta to mend relationships, or should he phone the President? What do you expect?
I think at the moment what we are requesting is very clear. The earlier clarification we receive, that will clear the air. It's not advisable to maintain the status quo of not confirmed, not denied, if there is any tapping incident in the past. I think this is something that we are waiting at the moment, because at stake is the strategic relation that we already established.
What sort of damage could be done to the relationship?
Well, I think this is a very serious matter. We are talking about trust and confidence in this regard. The trust and confidence really at what we anticipate is among the Indonesian citizens, among the government officials. We cannot build trust when we know that we have a kind of suspicions if our discussion, our internal close discussion, is being listened by others, of which the substance can be used later on during the negotiation on some other substantive issues. We need to clear the air at this stage.
What could happen if he doesn't respond?
We will discuss what other measures we will take, but I think this is something that we take very seriously.
Last night, President Yudhoyono met with at least three government ministers who are key to Australia's interests: the Agriculture Minister, who oversees beef imports, the Coordinating Minister in charge of cooperation on asylum seekers, and the Foreign Minister. Tuku Faizer Shah says many agreements with Australia are now at stake.
The ramifications of a major crackdown on undocumented foreign workers in Saudi Arabia is being felt 2 weeks on from its implementation. Saudi authorities have been detaining and deporting tens of thousands of workers who don't have the proper documentation to remain in the country. The kingdom's economy has long relied on low-paid laborers from countries such as India and the Philippines, but a rising jobless rate among Saudi citizens has prompted the crackdown. Bill Bertels reports.
Modern Saudi Arabia has in many ways been built by foreign labour. There's an estimated 9 million overseas workers in the kingdom, from countries such as India, Pakistan and the Philippines, doing everything from construction to domestic work. But rising unemployment among Saudis prompted the government to announce an amnesty earlier this year for undocumented workers to get their papers in order or leave. Earlier this month, that amnesty ended. Gary Martinez from the Filipino organisation Migrant says tens of thousands of workers have been caught up in the crackdown.
There's still thousands of Filipinos have been affected. There's a lot of Filipinos are still lining up outside our embassy and consulate. And there's a lot of call coming from their families are asking how they can repatriate their loved ones.
He says there are now thousands of workers in Saudi Arabia wanting to return to the Philippines, but who are not receiving adequate help.
The Philippine embassy official in Saudi Arabia, they are not listening to their demands. That's why most of Filipino workers are decided to put a tent city outside our embassy in Riyadh and tent city in our consulate in Jeddah.
And what are some of the issues that overseas labourers have faced while working in Saudi Arabia?
Yes, because of this kafala system like sponsorship program between the Philippine government and the Saudi Arabian government. The problem with this system, the workers cannot transfer their job to other employee because they're signed a contract. Some of them had been maltreated, some of them had been raped. Some of them had been working from 5 a.m. to 3 a.m. in the morning. They didn't receive their salary. Their travel documents or passport had been confiscated, and even their personal cell phone.
Around 10% of Saudi Arabia's foreign workforce is believed to be living there illegally. KV Shamsuddin runs the Pravasi Bantu Welfare Trust in the United Arab Emirates, which helps Indian workers manage their finances. He says many of the undocumented foreign nationals came on pilgrimage, stayed on to work, and are mistreated by employers.
Employers will exploit in the salary, in the accommodation, all the other facilities. And not only that, all the workers sometimes has to pay every month some amount to the sponsor who have given them the visa. That is happening. So there are a lot of such exploitation were happening. But when it legalize all the workers in the legal framework, that kind of exploitation will not be there.
Mr. Shamsuddin believes the crackdown on illegal migrants isn't a sign of a longer-term shift away from foreign labour in Saudi Arabia. He says locals won't be willing to work the low-paid and often menial jobs that foreign workers do.
That kind of work, locals, the nationals, are not going to do. So they require a large number of expatriate workers at least next 25 years. They require a large number of expatriates. So when they streamline, when they legalize all the expatriates also, there will be lot of chances for expatriates again in the legal way and come to work. What will happen? The salary scale will improve. The other facilities like accommodation, transportation, this all will improve. It will be very good for the expatriates workers.
And Gary Martinez says despite the crackdown, Filipino workers will also continue to head to Saudi Arabia in future years.
Saudi will be the one who will suffer because they need the cheap labor. They need migrant workers who used to work at we call this the 3D jobs, the dirty, difficult and dangerous job. And there's no Saudi national are willing to replace them.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. The Marshall Islands government has accused Japan of using its closure of the nuclear power plants as an excuse for slashing commitments to cut emissions. The comments come as world leaders gathered in Poland for the latest round of the United Nations climate negotiations. The minister in assistance to the Marshall Island president, Senator Tony DeBrum, told Bruce Hill that the recent moves of the governments in Australia and Canada set a bad example.
We have arrived in Warsaw expecting a lot more than the disappointments that have greeted us. Japan's announcement following Australia. It seems maybe the Australia is not aware that it's setting a bad example for some of our other allies worldwide who see its actions as indicative of the way to go for those who do not agree with a larger number of nations in the world on climate change.
But why do you think countries like Australia and Canada and now Japan seem to be going backwards on their commitments? Do they know something you don't? Or have they explained to you why they're doing it?
They have not. We do not think that they know something that we don't. I think the science out there is very clear. Japan is trying to justify its action on the basis of Fukushima. We think that is a very lame excuse. In the case of Australia, we don't see an excuse at all.
Well, in the case of Japan, my understanding is they've cut their carbon emission target from 25% to 3.1% because they're shutting down their nuclear reactors, and this means to keep their power up, they're having to import more coal and use more coal-fired power stations to replace the nuclear stuff that they've actually had to turn down. That seems like a pretty good excuse to me.
No, it is not. There are other ways that Japan can cope with this. Also, there are other technologies out there that Japan could be investing in to make up for the shortfall. I think this is just an excuse using Fukushima. But also, you know, with Australia making its own announcements, I mean, Japan's announcement from 25 to 3.1 is tantamount to saying 25 to nothing, because 3.1 doesn't do anything.
Well, we've got the Australian Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, who says he plans to repeal Australia's carbon tax. Canada's Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, is actually encouraging other countries to follow Australia's example. What do you think about comments like these?
You know, when the Pacific Rim is responsible for more than its share of world pollution, it should be the Pacific countries that take the leadership position in making sure that the rest of the world follows. Instead, we have Japan, Canada, and Australia doing this number on us. You know, in a big conference like the UNFCCC, you would expect one or two rogues to emerge. But never in our wildest dreams did we expect that those rogues might be our own big brother neighbors, Australia, Canada, and Japan.
Well, you've actually said previously on Pacific Beat that you'd like to invite Australia's Foreign Minister, Julie Bishop, to visit the Marshall Islands to see firsthand the impact of climate change. Have you issued that invitation? Has she made any response yet?
We have not been able. I was going to see the good minister in China, but was not able to make that meeting because of climate change issues like typhoons shutting down airline services to the Marshalls. But we hope to renew the invitation. As she knows, she has a standing invitation to come visit us. I extended it prior to her becoming the minister, and she told me, win, lose, or draw, Senator Broome, I will come and visit you.
Well, the Kyoto Agreement only half worked. Nothing really happened at Copenhagen. Are we expecting anything to happen at Warsaw?
We never give up hope. We're here because we trust there is a way out of our difficulties, and we will use all our Pacific powers, including Pacific magic, to see if we can move this thing along. We cannot give up at this point in time. The Marshall Islands now chair the forum. It's important that we speak up for the region.
I've got to ask you, Senator, what do you mean Pacific Island magic?
Well, you know, I don't know how to describe Pacific Island magic. I'm saying if there's a way to do it, we'll find it.
And finally on the program, we tell you about Jakarta-born Karina Utomo, who is forging musical links between Australia and Indonesia with a hearty mix of heavy metal punk as her soundtrack, and she's winning fans in both countries. We have this report from Arlene O'Hallon.
When it comes to rock and roll, Australia has its share of famous names, from Paul Kelly to Kylie Minogue, Silverchair and AC/DC. But it's here in Melbourne that the live music scene is really thriving, from rock to punk, even bilingual heavy metal. So hold on for a white-knuckle ride with Karina Utomo.
Karina Utomo is the most unlikely heavy metal punk princess you'll ever meet.
Please make a very welcome Karina Utomo!
The Jakarta-born singer is the vocal powerhouse with Melbourne band High Tension.
I was born in Jakarta, stayed there till I was 8. And, you know, probably the closest punk or closest rock band that I was exposed to was Guns N' Roses. It wasn't until I moved to Canberra that I fell in love with, you know, punk music.
Growing up in the capital cities of Indonesia and Australia, Karina has moved comfortably between big cities and different cultures all her life. But it's here in Melbourne, Australia's live music capital, that she's finding her feet and her voice as a budding rock star.
Karina, a lot of Indonesians come here to study, but you're here with musical dreams. So why did you choose Melbourne?
I actually did move here to study initially. And then, you know, music sort of dominated my life. Melbourne is, you know, pretty much the place to, if you want to play in a band.
With appearances on national TV and radio, Karina Utomo has become a name to watch in the Australian music industry. Now she has a new band and a new album and an upcoming Australian tour to test the new material.
Like, punk music should be accessible to absolutely everybody, and that's the way it should be. And I think, you know, people are opening their minds a bit to that.
Her bandmates are all friends, and songwriting is a team effort, but the lyrics are solely Karina's domain.
A lot of the time, you can't really understand the lyrics with this type of singing, but it is very important.
Vocals are also just as much an instrument as the guitarist, so, you know, I'll come up with a riff and she'll just kind of do something over the top that just matches it perfectly in terms of rhythm.
And with a fan base growing in Australia and Indonesia, the only high tension on the musical horizon is the growing list of places Karina's hoping to tour with her band.
The songs that we write, a lot of my lyrics are about Jakarta and they are about Indonesia, and there's aspects of it that I always touch on in our music. It's important for me to be able to share that. So I guess having that platform is important.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you want to listen to this program again or past editions, you can visit our website at any time. The URL is www.pcjmedia.com/FAP. This Sunday, you can catch another edition with Andy Sennett at 1330 UTC, targeting listeners in Southeast and East Asia on a frequency of 9335 kilohertz. That's 9335 kilohertz at 1330 UTC. If you want to let us know what you think of the program, our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. So on behalf of the whole team that helped put the program together, I'm Keith Parent wishing you well. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. Until then, so long and take care.